picture this. You're stepping into one of those old photo booths, the ones tucked into the corner of a train station or a shopping centre. There's the cold feel of the curtain ring, the sticky vinyl on the stool, the small shuffle as you pull the curtain shut behind you, and suddenly you're in a private little theatre. There's a mirror, just enough time for a quick adjustment, and then the countdown begins. Flash, then again, and again. You wait for that faint grinding sound as the strip slowly appears. If you've done this before, it all feels completely ordinary, but almost everything in that sequence has already been decided for you. The distance to the lens, the angle of the light, how long you have between frames, where your face will land in the picture. The machine has written the script in advance. You just step in and perform yourself inside it. That is what I want to get at today. The photo booth is something much more than a gadget. When Anatole Yousefo set up that first photometon in New York in the mid-1920s, he did not just make self-portraits cheaper and faster. He created a repeatable sentence structure for the face. The distance to the lens is fixed. The lighting is frontal and supposedly neutral. You are told where to sit, where to look, when to hold still. No smiling too broadly, no big movements, try not to blink. In a matter of seconds, the booth teaches you a small grammar of how a face should appear for a machine, and once you learn it, you carry that grammar with you. Over time, even the most casual user, who is not thinking about any of this consciously, starts to internalize that script. We act for the camera in the way the machine expects. Sit here, look straight ahead, do not move, flash, flash, flash. The real genius of the booth is not just the technology, it is its quiet ability to train us to be legible to a camera. Before the booth, a portrait usually involved a whole negotiation with a human photographer. How serious should you look? What to do with your hands? Which angle feels right? In the booth, all of that is pre-decided. You either fall into the format, or you test its limits and try to break the mold, which is where the really interesting experiments with identity begin. And that is the tension we are going to stay with in this episode. The booth teaches us to be recognizable and standard, but almost immediately you see people bending the rules, playing, performing, even quietly rebelling against the format. The same narrow frame that makes you machine readable also becomes a stage for trying on other selves. So in this episode, we will follow that thread and see how a little box with a curtain ended up choreographing a century of identity. Now, inside the curtain, things get strange. That standardized frame, that little metal cubicle, is doing two opposite things at once. On one hand, think of a photo strip in a lover's notebook, taped into a diary or stuck to a fridge, a small, warm keepsake that feels private and personal. On the other hand, the exact same kind of strip, same pose, same frontal geometry, gets stapled to a passport application or dropped into a bureaucratic file, and suddenly it becomes evidence, proof of identity. The booth uses the very same rules to produce both intimacy and officialdom, and it does not distinguish between the two. That thick curtain is both a shield and a funnel. Inside you have privacy, people kiss, pull faces, cram in with three or four friends, try things they might not do in front of a live photographer. The same curtain that feels like it is keeping secrets is attached to a machine that produces images perfectly formatted to leave that space and circulate, to be judged, classified, or archived. There is a particular psychological effect in being alone, but under the eye of a process rather than a person. You are not being watched by a photographer, you are being timed by a mechanism, and you adjust yourself to its rhythm. Then there is the background, neutral, blank. Institutions like that because it lets them claim these are objective images, just the face and nothing else, everyone treated the same. That is why the same format feels perfect for IDs, visas, and official documents. But is it really objective? I am skeptical. Even that so-called neutrality carries a whole set of cultural assumptions about what a proper face should look like, how composed you should be, which expressions count as serious or trustworthy and which do not. So on one level, the booth is there to mark bonds of friendship and family, the small rituals of anniversaries, breakups, and pure nonsense moments. On another, it is a tool for authorities to mark, verify, sort, and track. Care and control, delivered through the same narrow format. That is not just a contradiction, it is a sign of how powerful a simple structure can be when it is shared across our most intimate and our most administrative moments. But inside that standard frame, small changes make all the difference. A tweak in the hair, a tilt of the chin, a different shirt, a sly grin instead of a straight face. The booth is not just a recorder, it behaves like a casting director. Give someone a strip of four images and they automatically start reading them as a sequence. Shy in the first one, serious in the second, then suddenly a big laugh in the third, maybe a collapse or an eye roll in the last. What is the story there? People often look at those four frames and see a different type in each one, as if they are meeting several characters rather than a single person in slightly different moods. This is where identity starts to stretch. One person can sit in the same booth, one strip after another, and perform a new self in every frame. You see it in artists like Andy Warhol, who made dozens, even hundreds, of strips in different wigs, sunglasses, and moods. Lay them all out, and at a glance it feels like you are looking at an entire cast. This one reads as dreamy, that one as tough, another as fragile or amused. What you are watching, in real time, is how quickly we read a handful of visual cues and turn them into a type. That is semiotics in action, even if you never use the term. We are constantly turning hair, clothing, expression, and angle into stories about who someone is. Put simply, semiotics is just the study of how signs carry meaning. In this case, the fixed booth is the grammar, the small poses and tweaks are the words, and the strip becomes a strange little sentence about who you are. The more standardized that setup is, the easier it is for us to read it at a glance. But that same ease is what tempts us into shorthand and stereotype, because once a format is familiar, we rush to fill it in with ready-made types. But here is the part I find most valuable. The booth is a rehearsal space. You try out a tougher face for an ID, a softer one for someone you care about, a ridiculous one just to make a friend laugh. Those experiments do not stay inside the strip. They spill out into our selfies, our job applications, our profile pictures and avatars. Over time, a lot of what we think of as me is really a set of practiced performances, tuned and retuned inside whatever visual formats feel familiar and safe enough to play in. So let's take a turn into something we use consistently in teaching and working with clients. Narrative intelligence. By that I mean a practical skill, not quite a science, more like a trained habit, of hearing the small stories that devices are telling before anyone spells them out. Every booth, every strip, quietly scripts a set of possibilities, and if you pay attention, you start to see the same poses and archetypes surfacing again and again. Narrative intelligence is the work of cataloguing those patterns, almost like a detective going through evidence, noticing which gestures repeat, which moods the format seems to invite, and what kinds of characters it keeps nudging into view. The photo booth, for instance, is basically a little story generator. That strip of four frames, boom, 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 almost always falls into a mini arc. In the first frame, you are composed, still testing the waters. In the second, you relax into a smile. By the third, you are doing something bigger or stranger, a silly face, a shout, a surprise. In the fourth, whatever is left in the tank comes out, a kiss, a collapse, an eye roll. You see those beats over and over again, not just because people copy each other, but because the format itself, the countdown, the tight timing, the four shots and no more, pushes us to tell a tiny story inside it. In a writer's room, you sketch different versions of a scene, test what works, and see what sticks. Culturally, we are doing something similar all the time, trying out new scripts for how to look, pose, and perform. The photo booth is a small test lab for that work. And if we get good at listening to these built-in stories, we can do more than describe what is happening. We can start tinkering with the script underneath. If the booth quietly pushes you towards certain outcomes, what happens if you nudge the process? Add a frame, slow the countdown, change the lighting, or shift where the camera sits. Each tweak opens up different stories, different ways of being seen. We will come back to that later on, especially when we look at how digital platforms inherit so much of the booth's basic logic and then accelerate it. Now here is where it gets more complex. Today, if you are building a dating app or a hiring tool or a government ID system, the basic logic of the photo booth is everywhere. You condense a person into something quickly legible, a handful of photos, a short bio, a few key fields. You wrap it all in a format built for rapid judgment. The strip becomes the swipe, a face on a screen, a gesture to the left or right, a quick yes or no. The goal is the same as it was in the booth. Turn complex people into simple, scannable units so decisions can be made fast. When whole lives get squeezed into these tiny formats, the result for many people in their 20s is an algorithmic churn that feels like endless ghosting and quiet cracking. There are obvious upsides. It is efficient. It lets you compare many cases at a glance. You might be sifting through job applications, or dating profiles, or faces at a border checkpoint. There is also a kind of clarity. Is this a match? Does this face fit what we are looking for? Do they meet the criteria? I understand why platforms lean into this logic. It feels like it gives people agency. At least the rules of the game are visible, and you can try to play to them. But at the same time, once you start tuning your identity to fit those narrow signals, the right smile, the right filter, the optimal job title, you begin to lose nuance. Entire versions of who you could be simply drop out of frame. The more a system standardizes, the more it quietly defines what counts as acceptable, normal, even real. The categories harden. Anything that falls outside the strip, so to speak, barely registers in the system at all. It is worth sitting with this for a moment, because every small design choice in these systems, the time you get to decide, the size of the image, even the background color, quietly shapes how you behave. The booth's countdown nudges you into a rapid escalation of expression. A swipe interface teaches you to make snap judgments, to be bolder or more dismissive, or to retreat altogether. Formats train us. They reward certain moves and make others awkward or invisible. So it is a fair question to ask yourself, what stories about who you should be have you absorbed simply because a particular format demanded it, and you went along without noticing? So now the design challenge is not just about adding features, but about noticing which performances and stories a system quietly rewards. Every interface is courting certain versions of you and making others harder to sustain. So the sharper question becomes, what identities are being invited in and amplified here, and which ones are being flattened, sidelined, or quietly pushed out of the frame? In 2025, photo booths are having a real revival. It is not just people chasing retro vibes. Young users are queuing for analog booths at festivals, and in malls, and at pop-ups, and at parties. Nostalgia plays a role. But there is something more pointed going on. The process is slow and you can feel the strip in your hand. There is a real risk that the shot will be awkward or slightly off. That risk feels almost radical now. You cannot swipe away the result. You cannot smooth it with a filter. The moment is anchored in a physical object. It can crease. It can fade. It can live in a wallet or on a wall. That stubborn material quality stands in quiet opposition to the endlessly editable images on our phones. What is striking about this comeback is how the strip becomes both proof and play at once, and how that speaks to our uneasy relationship with technology more broadly. In a booth, the mechanics are simple and fixed. One lens, one light, Four frames, no filters, no sliders, no invisible system deciding which version of you matters. If you want the image to change, you have to change. You shift your posture. You lean in or pull away. You squeeze three friends into the frame. You raise an eyebrow instead of raising the exposure. The creative work moves back into the body. There is another piece that often gets overlooked, which is how these strips age. They crease and fade, they get lost in drawers and found again. They are taped to a wall for a while and then peeled off and tucked into a box, or scanned and digitized years later. Unlike our online avatars, which can be endlessly polished and refreshed, that strip is a record of a particular moment that also carries the wear of everything that happened afterward. It is proof of the passage of time. It sits inside memory rather than hovering above it. Digital platforms rarely replicate that feeling, that sense of a shared, lived past attached to an artifact that is allowed to age alongside us. In the context of social unease, people are quietly using the booth as a way to test different kinds of togetherness, different ways of marking that we were here. In doing so, they are also offering a soft critique of platform culture and asking a bigger question. If this old machine can support new rituals so easily, what other kinds of shared practices might be possible outside the swipe and the feed? So what is the takeaway, if there is one? For me, it is that constraints do not just hem us in, they choreograph us. The photo booth's rules created a reliable, repeatable situation, and people still found ways to reveal themselves, to subvert the script, to surprise each other inside that tiny frame. That is the kind of choreography we should be aiming for in future systems, whether we are talking about IDs, apps, or any other tool that asks us to show our faces. We need to keep asking not only what data a system collects, but how its structure shapes the performances we can imagine, and which versions of ourselves it makes easier or harder to bring into view. Here is the key point. We need firm structures, but they should not dictate what kind of person belongs inside them. The photo booth tells you where to sit, where to look, and when the flash is coming. It does not tell you to act tough, to smile big, or to tone anything down. Identity flourishes when the structure sets the stage clearly, but leaves the role open when the frame is strong enough to hold many different ways of showing up instead of steering everyone toward the same narrow script. It gets risky when we treat verification and imagination as if they are enemies. If we designed for both at once, you could imagine ID systems or profile tools where you can prove who you are and, at the same time, say something about how you see yourself. Not just ticking a box or fitting a template, but folding in a bit of your own story alongside the official facts. If you are designing for the future, pay attention to the small gestures and the informal rituals that form around a new tool. Those little stories, half play, half trial run, often hint at where culture is heading long before metrics or surveys catch up. Learning to spot them early is one way to keep from locking creativity out in the name of efficiency, and to build systems that leave space for people to improvise new ways of being themselves. So before we wrap up, here is something to chew on. What frames are shaping how you show up at work, online, in official documents, even among friends? Which of those structures feel generous, and which ones squeeze you into awkward poses? If one metal box with a curtain could spark a century of rituals around identity, what might a new generation of identity systems make possible, especially if we design them with enough room for stories that have not been told yet? Thank you for joining me for this episode. Until next time, keep an eye on the frames around you and the stories they're quietly teaching you to tell.